Good morning. I hope you had a successful sleep. And I welcome you to day 4 of Born Hack, to the speaker's tent, to the first talk of Paul Henning Kemp. And surely FOSS has no technical debt, right? Right. Give him a warm welcome.
So what language? Danish, English, or Sydvestjyllandsk? English, okay. So this talk is brought to you by a comment from GitHub that says, I do not plan to remove pre-ISOC compatibility at this time. I'll get back to that. But first, a Jeopardy quiz. Jeopardy, you have to come up with the answer. Oh, sorry, you have to come up with the question. I give the answer. This is the first clue. What is the question? No? Still nobody? This is from Wikipedia's page on the subject. The question is, of course, what is technical debt? Technical debt is, it sounds easy to do something. And by the time you're done, it's no longer easy because there's 275 different special cases. And by the way, somebody introduced a new version of the protocol in the meantime, and so on. Everything gets more complicated with time. And the tendency is to just keep adding stuff and never removing stuff. And that's basically what technical debt is. You never catch up and get back to a clean, nice solution because you have all this old compatibility stuff. I had an idea involving making a change to the rsync program related to encrypting stuff for offsite backups. And I thought, how hard can that be? Rsync is from 1992. It's based on a very smart idea from Andrew Tridgell. They've used version control from version 0.9 in 96. That's where a lot of people started using version control. And 7,500 commits later, we're at version 3.3 now. It's 61,000 lines of code, 10,000 of which is they have their own copy of the compression library. And there's like 5,000 lines in the manual page explaining all the weird things you can do with rsync. For instance, do you want character set conversion on your extended attributes when you move them from an IBM to a Linux machine? Hands up if you ever used that. So I sat down in my beach house during summer vacation and cleaned up rsync. And by cleaned up, I mean the kind of thing we talk about when we say, I cleaned up the attic, I cleaned up the garage. I threw a lot of shit out. I started to remove stuff on the basic principle that I have never even thought about using this. And if anybody told me they use it, I would tell them they were crazy. There are four different compression algorithms available in rsync. The difference at best is in low percentages. It shouldn't even happen in rsync. It should be done on the SSH layer. There's a batch mode, which is like, have you heard about shell scripts? There's a daemon mode. It can act as its own web server, network server. Anonymous rsync, anybody remember that? Conversion of character sets, extended attributes, access control list. It just goes on. It has support for all versions of the rsync internal protocol that has ever been. There's a command line option where you can say use version 7 of the rsync protocol. If for some reason you want to travel back to 1990, whatever. This is simply accumulating stuff over and over again. And by the time I was done, I had removed the core part of rsync from 46,000 lines of code to 27,000 lines of code. That means there's 40% gone. I found a bug, and I tried reporting it, but they couldn't see it because of all the layers of junk on top of it. It's not important, so it's, but it's a bug. But it's hidden by all these accumulated layer of cruft. This is what a bank or an insurance company would call legacy software and pay some consultancy an exorbitant amount of money to replace. And before you ask, no, I'm not going to release this version of rsync because I don't want to become maintainer of rsync. So why the fuck does rsync have a copy of the compression library in the first place? I wrote an article about that many years ago, that we have been incredibly bad at managing standard libraries in the open source environment. I did an audit over the FreeBSD port collection. You can go into user ports and you can say make extract and you get all the source code for all the ports and you can start grabbing it. It takes some time. But basically, there were 1,300 copies of standard encryption and hashing algorithms included in the source code of all the various ports. Because there's not a standard library you can link to, so I'll bring my own. And by the way, I don't like the way they formatted it, so I'll reformat it and stuff like that. It's an endemic problem in the open source environment. The not invented here is very strong with us. So architecture and stuff like that is not strong with us. So we'll take another quiz. This is the year that DNS was introduced.
1985.
Well, 1984. 85, you got it. Here's the rest of the hints. So what happened otherwise in 1985? Well, patent 4558302. Anybody know what that is? That is the Lemble sieve compression patent that made it dubious whether you could use the Unix compress program without paying royalties to Unisys. It made commercial Unix vendors remove the compress program from the distributions, unless they were Unisys, which were very proud that they had a file compression utility in that Unix. This made a lot of trouble for compression, and it makes somebody sit down and write a new compression algorithm. So we'll try again. What year is this? 98, 96. Are we in the wrong culture here? Is that better? No?
92, 96, 97.
Really? The Clib library was released in 95. It was taken out of the gzip program and turned into a library. Or more precisely, the gzip program was turned into a library because then one part of it has the gzip, except then gzip grew some other things, so now we have gzip and mini gzip and stuff like that. And 1985 is quite a long time ago. My daughter is doing a PhD. She's from 96. And that's probably why the maintenance of the Clib library is not very high intensity, let's call it that. The most recent commit is from October last year. And there's like 143 bug reports and 200 pull requests waiting for Mark Adler to do something about it. Some of them are very obscure, such as using the IBM mainframe's special data compression instructions. I would myself be hesitant to include that. But some of them are right there just to take them. One of them is that the new version of LLVM has started complaining about pre-ISOC lack of prototypes. The good old Kernighan and Ritchie were right. Function name, name of parameter, and then on a separate line you write the type of the parameters. And Mark Adler responded to that no, he doesn't plan to remove that at this time. And By the way, they're wrong with that warning in another VM because I know better. This out here on the left side is the entire thread under that issue. This part of it is Mark Adler arguing that he knows better than the ISOC what the ISOC says. Until the guy who's trying to educate him says, forget it. The next set part of it is all the other software projects starting to work around the stubborn old ass. They have to go into autocrap and say this directory shouldn't use this C warning option. That's not going well for a lot of them. It's easier for somebody like FreeBSD that has local makefiles and stuff. But this is basically, his stubbornness makes work for everybody else. This is what technical debt is at its worst. So if you look at the source code for the C-lib, you'll maybe spot a pattern in the if-defs. Hand in the air if more than five of these have ever been relevant for you. I can tell the color of your beard. How many people have worked on a Unix that didn't have standard argument.h? Do you remember how you did varax before that?
Manipulating the stack by your hand, effectively?
Basically, yeah. If you're lucky, there were macros to help you. So Mark has solved all these portability problems over the time. And quite honestly, that sort of messes up the source code a bit. Clib is not the most readable source code there is, but he's been very competent doing it. It's well thought out. But I can understand why he doesn't want to touch that again. And I can also understand that he's proud of some of those solutions, or solutions to problems that shouldn't exist, we might say. So he doesn't want to remove that. He spent an entire summer doing that, just throwing it out. That's a very hard thing to get over as a person. So in Danish, we have a concept from Holberg called a Geronimus, which is a stop on old cuss. This is somebody, well, he's probably 35 in the original Holberg comedies, maybe 40. But it's a person who's old, who knows how these things work, and all this new stuff is humbug. Right? There's an even worse one. I love this word. This is a medical diagnosis in Denmark. Many of the sufferers have made some inventions, got a patent on it, and nobody wants it. And they feel slighted. And at every single instance, every chance they have, they'll bring up their invention and explain how they would solve all the problems. And you end up with a history like the one over here from the Danish Engineering Society, where almost all your entries get removed because they're not relevant to the topic at hand. Here's another example. David Allen invented the Allen variance, which is the two sampled variants used a lot in time and frequency and stuff like that. Had a brilliant career, then he goes into retirement. And what do you do in retirement? You have to show you're brilliant, right? So you go after the largest scalp there is, Einstein's unified field theory. Prove it wrong, or something. So he starts trying to show something, something about his version of the grand unified theory by taking two pendulum clocks and putting capacitors under one of them and a battery under the other one. So one is electrostatic energy, the other is chemical energy. And that, in his theory, should make them not go at the same rate or something. This is utterly insane. And there is an IT security angle on this. People approaching this segment has a very large influence. Too much, I will argue. You shouldn't listen to old assholes like me. They make very fundamental decisions. Going into standardization is a standard retirement kind of thing to get people out of the organization, right? hey, Vint, why don't you go to the standardization meetings for us? You know everything about this, right? And they're not quite up to date on today's situation. It's like, ah, this new thing, right? And they're very hard to get rid of. I'm coming here year after year. See what I mean? Dave Mills more or less caused the internet. He's the guy who wrote the proposal for the research program that led to the internet while working at DARPA. He'd been working at something called the DCNet, which is really an internet before before the internet. He loved to play with computers and timekeeping and made that his thing, and then he starts to lose his eyesight. The last email he read from me, he read in 30-point Helvetica and complained about the long lines. And that's fair, right? But sort of, you know, security issues, that sort of stuff, that was not his problem. And if we tried to get patches in, it's like, I cannot review this. So it's like the entire thing grinds to a halt and he doesn't realize he's the stopping block for it. Daniel is a really nice dude from Sweden who collects CVEs. He also writes this program called Curl. This is number of CVEs against Curl plotted against year. The list is out there. This is a program most of us use to run shell scripts, right? Curl, pipe, bash.
Sudo bash.
Oh yeah, sudo bash, sorry. Right? But Daniel thinks if there is a protocol, it should speak it. And I keep teasing him, it doesn't do OSI TP4. And I fear the day that he will implement that. Right? But is that a way to maintain such a crucial piece of the global cybersecurity thing? I mean, removing the sudo program would help a lot more, but why does Gopher protocol exist in curl by default on pretty much all installations? Yeah, I can see the fun. I had a Gopher server 35 years ago. Right. Toby is a nice dude. He built the most comprehensive test suite there is for the CPAN archive. You just try to install SmokePing, and it pulls in all the packages from CPAN. Right. Technical debt comes from people. Roy, he knows more about HTTP than anybody else. And then somebody says, we should have a HTTP header that says, what you did here cost this much CO2 to be emitted. So that the browsers can put up a little window and you can see that 1 hour of porn will ruin the climate. And we get this Geronimo's answer back, arr, humbug. Right. He's not even thought about it, about the implications, about the educational part of it, about, humbug. Right. And instead, Roy said no. Right. The good news is it doesn't apply to me or to any of you. We're exempt from this. But my advice to you is put a mark in the calendar every time you feel like learning something new and actually learn it. It's like, oh, this thing sounds interesting. And you actually go down, read up, do the experiment, do your education so you know what this is. Or if you change your opinion about a person of your own age, by the time you get to my age, people are classified into nice, nice, okay, asshole. If you move people around those, you can put a cross in the calendar. Or if there's something, you know absolutely everything about this, and you go and research it anyway, you can put a cross in the calendar. And if you have an entire month without any crosses in the calendar, you're retired. You have stopped being intellectually curious. You have become Geronimus. You know how this works. You don't need input. You're fine. That's retirement. Mirrors should have this one in the corner, right? So that every morning when you stand there looking at it, you get reminded that something happened. And while I was making these slides, we have a discussion in FreeBSD, getting rid of 32-bit architectures. When was the last time you bought a 32-bit computer to install a Unix operating system on it? Right.
ARM is 32-bit.
Yeah, but...
It's nasty.
We're talking about what's going to happen in FreeBSD in version 14, 15, and 16. That's like next year, year after that. No, next year, 2 years after that, and 5 years from now, right? It's like, why is this even a question? Get rid of the shit. Let's move on. Right? So, we've had open source as a thing now for 40 years-ish. Kind of thing, depend when you started. Now we've collected a lot of technical debt. Now we need to start to deal with it so we don't leave that legacy to the next generations. And the solution is not to add a minus sudo bash option to curl. And I'm doing stuff in Computer History Museum, so next Sunday we have open. You can come and see us if you want, stuff like that. Questions? There must be some.
Thank you for the talk. My question is, how long do you think a computing device should be usable? Like, how many years old should something be before we drop support for it?
And you're asking about...
Have the museum slide here, so I appreciate that. But I mean, in a museum, you might be running the operating system it came with, you know?
I would say, from a sustainability point of view, a handheld device like a mobile phone should last at least 5 years and be relevant for at least 5 years. A larger piece of equipment should last at least 10 years. There's absolutely no problem building electronics that will last 10 years without any kind of trouble. It's slightly more expensive, but it's not very much more expensive. And I would say, I mean, that's the kind of thing that the EU could go in and say, you know, white goods, kitchen appliances, stuff like that, there will be 10-year warranty from now on. And it wouldn't hurt anybody any. But the more interesting question is, what about security updates? What happens when the vendor that made this goes bankrupt? Who does the security updates? And what do we do if nobody can do the security updates? Should there be a mandatory recall saying this device is no longer safe to use? They have to be stopped. Or should devices even come with a built-in timer that says, if I have not received a security update, even if it's a null update in the last 365 days, I'll kill myself. No, think seriously about it. Baby monitors have cameras these days. And one of the companies that made one that was sold widely in the US had an employee who had a side hustle because it transpires these cameras catch a lot of women in nightdresses. So there were websites for men who fancied women in nightdresses in black and white. And when this became known, the company goes bankrupt. And now you can't even disable all these cameras despite them running on a cloud service. Shouldn't there have been a dead man's hand in that says, okay, we'll keel over after, because this is just not safe any longer. We wouldn't allow that to not exist in a lot of other places. You're not allowed to walk away from a nuclear plant, even if you go bankrupt. That's not how it works. You're not allowed to walk away from a chemical plant if you go bankrupt. That's not how it works. And cybersecurity issues in consumer devices, that's environmental pollution if we don't do something about it. So I can see a situation where devices will come with one yearly software update, and when you haven't had a software update in a year, it will stop working. Break its own firmware. And I would welcome it.
Thank you for the thoughts on that. I've gotta say, I respectfully disagree with you on the. It's a good point, but the solution to this, in my opinion, is things like Postmarket OS, which says they're aiming for a 10-year lifespan for mobile phones, and using that, you can actually have today's software on a 10-year-old device. And
that's a fine solution, but who's going to do that for all the other devices?
I think mandating software updates for a certain period of time is a good idea, but having them automatically turn off when they don't get it seems like really shitty for people.
But how else to stop the problem? I mean, one of the major sources of spam last year was fridges.
I'd like to continue the conversation later. Let other people ask questions.
Other questions?
You mentioned the ARM 7 to make it obsolete. One of the CPUs is the Allwinner A20, which is an ARM 7, and Olimex says they will support it indefinitely. So you would not be able to run BSD on it then.
And I can live with that.
Okay. And we had a
couple. There are 64-bit chips that can do the same thing at the same price point. Okay.
Yeah. And we had a chemical plant where the owner went bankrupt, and there's a lot of white phosphorus in it that the province had to pay for, hundreds of millions of euros.
You mentioned technical debt being caused by people. What actually happens when those people actually leave the project?
We saw that with the NTP project. If it's important enough, it sort of limbers on and nothing happens. Which was a very bad situation because transpired there were some significant security holes. In theory, in the OS bazaar theory, somebody will fork the project and everybody will migrate to the newer, better fork, and everybody lives happily ever after. That doesn't seem to be happening that way. What seems to be happening is that somebody makes a fork and, like me, removes all the cruft he doesn't want without doing, should we say, market research, see if that's actually something a lot of people use. And somebody else makes a fork and says, I'm going to convert this to Rust, which is the new thing, or Haskell, or something like that. So you get a fragmentation. And maybe that's not a bad idea to sort of get rid of these very important pieces of software, get them split into smaller pieces, you know, too big to fail, so to speak. But it's not a controlled process. Whatever happens is whatever happens. And it depends on the people in the software and who uses it and what they realize, what they don't realize. And so on.
Thank you.
Hi. You didn't mention OpenSSL, but the fragmentation you're talking about right now happened. Do you know more about what, is that good or do you consider it good? It fragmented into at least three
I've
or five.
I've never considered OpenSSL good. It's one of the worst code bases it has ever been my displeasure to have to work on. That source code is awful. So in that sense, I would like to see them banished from this planet, made obsolete by better offerings. The problem about encryption is that it's very political, as we will be discussing later this afternoon. And pretty much all of the replacements I've seen come with significant political baggage. And I've always had the "I deliver tools, not policies" attitude to open source. I'm not the one who tells you how to run whatever you're trying to run. But I feel a lot of those libraries come with that kind of policies. And that's probably making OpenSSL live longer than it otherwise would. Because, well, we can always use OpenSSL, right?
Yeah. Isn't a big part of this issue that we continue to write all our software in these ancient languages using the same methods that we did in the 80s? Like for C and C++, they haven't received sort of competent standard library work in a very, very long time. Doesn't even have network support right now. It takes 10 lines to create a socket. And we continue to write software in it.
So the C language is victim of a particular incompetent standardization.
Absolutely.
The ISO C people must hate the language since they're trying to kill it. And that can be a valid position depending on who they are. C++ standardization, by comparison, seems to be incredibly competent. I don't know how much of that is because of Bjarne and how much is because they're just competent people. I'm considering, at the time, moving Varnish to C++ because of some of the recent brain farts from the ISO C standards. But no, I don't think it's anything to do with language. I mean, the problem existed in all languages that I have ever seen code in. Legacy software is something that exists because you never delete, you always add. It's very seldom you see people say, I fixed this problem by removing 500 lines of code, despite it often being possible. I don't think the problem will be solved until we start thinking about lines of code as depth in itself. You have not, when you have 1,000 lines of code, you do not have value of 1,000 lines of code. You have obligations of 1,000 lines of code. And until we take that attitude, I don't think the problem will be solved in a fundamental way. It's sort of like the quality is when you can remove no more attitude.
Do you think like software systems with good dependency management are making this better, like Rust or JavaScript? They have wide and deep dependency trees?
I don't think that's an either or. I mean, for instance, the big thing in science these days is Python. And you start out by saying import SciPy and import NumPy, and then you have your tool chest. And to be honest, I think that's safer than having your average student go hunting for a matrix library and finding something on Stack Overflow and right. So there is a value in having these industry standard, this is how we do it kind of things. There's portability stuff and stuff like that. But it takes curation. Somebody has to decide what's inside sci-fi and what's outside sci-fi. I think the first one where we saw this was actually the CPAN thing, where like anybody who wrote 10 lines of Perl, that became a CPAN module, right? And there was no curation whatsoever on that. And I think that and the syntax is a large reason why Perl is not relevant anymore, right? Because you end up depending on so many maintainers that if anything works today, it's pure luck. As I said, I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all. You have different places you come from in different parts of the business. If you're doing embedded systems that run on no power, like gas meters, you don't want to pull in CPAN or SciPy or something like that. You want to have tight control of every bit of code. And if you're trying to write a PhD, you just want it to work, right? So it's different places. So I don't think that one has an answer. Yeah?
Any ideas on how to quantify technical depth more standardized? And any ideas of where the retired man should go and standardize it?
Into his garden. I think the fundamental thing is to realize that writing a line of code means now you have a maintainer responsibility for that line of code as long as anybody ever uses it. And this comes from the guy who released a program called SCSIPing in 1992, which people still use to put hard disks on their old Suns. Still getting emails about it. And which is why I'm not going to release my rsync version. I mean, to be brutally honest, let's have a tax on a line of code. The world would be a better place. Something like, you know, 1 microcent per line of code per year. A lot of code would vanish, disappear, and nobody would miss it.
We have plenty.
Right? And we'd still have plenty enough left. But that is the change of mentality that this takes, is thinking about it as depth from the start.
So talking to a person who has built a lot of useful software himself, how do you incentivize people to build useful software? Because there is a lot of code in GitHub that is unmaintained and unused by anybody. So that doesn't come with any requirement to maintain it, because nobody is using it. But once you build something that is actually useful to a lot of people, they start depending on it, and they start throwing in bug reports, they start throwing in requests for features, for pull requests, and all of a sudden you are a maintainer and you have to say yes and no, and you review code, and that's not why you built the tool in the first place.
So then you shouldn't have distributed it.
Okay, yeah, okay. But that's the pessimistic option. So.
No, I don't think it's a pessimistic option. The moment you give other people access to your code, you are the maintainer.
Okay.
And if you only use it yourself, you can decide to stop using it. You don't have to maintain it anymore.
Okay.
Right. But once other people start relying on your code, you are stuck on it. Hmm. And you take it from me. You'll never be free again.
No. I know that you maintain your code. It's just that.
No, I haven't.
I don't know. I don't know where you find the courage.
I have a lot of time.
Okay,
you do. A lot of code that I don't have the time to maintain. I wrote some code to pull numbers out of gas meters at one point, and I haven't had natural gas for 10 years. Mm. And people still ask me about it, despite a big slap on the top of the GitHub that says, "I don't maintain this. I don't have this anymore." Mm. Right. So no, you're stuck. There's no way around it.
But it just sounds
the
like
other side of that
job.
Is, I'm never going to be one to say, you're not allowed to code for fun. Hmm. You're perfectly allowed to code for fun. Just don't release it to people unless you want to stick up for it.
Hmm. Right.
Okay, so that seems to be the end of the urgent questions. Then. Let's thank the speaker again.